Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of June. And this hour, Tim Weiner is our guest, author of Legacy of Ashes. We have a big area to cover today, the history of the CIA, which is just out in paperback. The Boston Globe has said in its review this is must reading for every presidential candidate who wants to understand why the nation repeatedly stumbles into one disaster abroad after another. Tim is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's reported on American intelligence from around the world for more than 20 years. As a reporter for the New York Times, he's investigated CIA covert operations firsthand and worked as a foreign correspondent in 18 nations, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sudan, Kenya, Cuba, Mexico, Latin American countries, covering wars, coups, and foreign policies of the United States. He spent 10 years as a Washington correspondent covering national security and the CIA, breaking more than 100 page one stories during the last 7 years. He's also worked for the Kansas City Times and for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We are going to take phone calls for him. I'm sure there will be quite a few because there is so much to cover here. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 if you are joining us in Milwaukee. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. Hello, Tim. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good to be back with you.
You went through a lot of work to do this, didn't you? I mean, so many documents, talked to so many people. It's a big piece of work.
It's the culmination of 20 years of work.
Whew! That's a lot. Let's start, if you don't mind, because I don't think too many of us know this story about the Soviet Union and this estimate of Soviet nuclear forces. These were the days. I was a kid during those days. We were all doing these drills. We thought that they were going to get us. We thought we were going to die. And we were doing, you know, drills underneath the fallout shelters and underneath your desks at school, et cetera. Talk about how the CIA overestimated the capability of the Soviet Union during that time. It is remarkable how it was overestimated.
Well, when the Cold War began and the CIA was created in 1947, the goal was to prevent another Pearl Harbor. And the fear was that if that Pearl Harbor came, that it would come from the Soviet Union. It was a shock to the United States when the Soviets got the bomb in 1949. And there was a series of continuing shocks over the next decade. The fact is, we didn't know anything about the Soviet Union.
Oh, my.
It was a mystery to us. It was a closed police state. Spying behind the Iron Curtain was almost impossible. And so the CIA put out a series of estimates throughout the 1950s and the early 1960s. And I think the best way to summarize that is to quote Gerry Ford, the former president of the United States, who was a member of Congress throughout those years and who in 1962 sat on the very small House subcommittee that provided the CIA's secret budget. So he was briefed. And this is what Gerry Ford had to say about the CIA's estimates through the 60s and 70s. The CIA would come in and paint the most scary picture possible about what the Soviets would do to us. We were going to be second rate. The Soviets were going to be number one. They had charts on the wall. They had figures. And their conclusion was that in 10 years, meaning by the 1970s, the United States would be behind the Soviet Union in military capability, in economic growth. It was a scary presentation. This is the president of the United States talking. The facts are, they were 180 degrees wrong. These were the best people we had, the CIA's so-called experts.
Wow.
This level of presidential frustration with what the CIA could and could not do for presidents was expressed by President Eisenhower, by President Kennedy, by President Johnson, by President Nixon, by President Ford, the list is long, on down through the years. Now, it cuts both ways. Part of the job of the CIA is to speak truth to power, to give the president the unvarnished facts about what's going on in the world. The trouble is CIA directors didn't always have their facts straight, and when they did, presidents didn't always want to hear them. It takes two people to speak the truth, one to speak it, one to hear it.
Mm-hmm. So they would bring forth truth that in some cases they knew was what the president wanted to hear, flattering them, agreeing with whatever their policy was going
to
be.
Well, presidents don't mind hearing intelligence that conforms with their preconceptions.
Right.
Presidents don't like surprises. Presidents also want the CIA to carry out covert action, covert operations that will solve problems for them instantly. That's very hard to do. But let me give you the other side of the coin. The CIA told President Johnson in 1966 and 1967 that the war in Vietnam was a political war, that it was not going to be won by military means alone, that the will of the Vietnamese communists to persist was strong.
Hmm.
You think the president wanted to hear that?
No.
He did not.
No.
So we have the same problem today. You know, the CIA in 2004 had a lot of answering to do for the fact that it had told the president and the White House and the United States and the United Nations and the world and the American people above all. The CIA had reported that Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, was bristling with chemical and biological weapons,
mm-hmm.
weapons of mass destruction. And we went to war,
mm-hmm.
in large part on the basis of that intelligence reporting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And come to find out, there was no arsenal. So the agency had a lot to answer for. The following year, in the summer of 2004, the CIA reports to the White House, you know, this occupation is not working out too well. You think President Bush wanted to hear that? He did not.
Mm-hmm.
And a reporter asked the president that summer, this is 4 years ago, President Bush, didn't the CIA tell you that things could get a little dicey in Iraq after Saddam Hussein? And the president replied, well, the CIA said things could be great, and the CIA said things could be lousy. They were just guessing, just guessing.
Mm.
So that is the kind of presidential anger with which the CIA has had to put up.
Mm-hmm. There were, as I recall, some members of the CIA, and they weren't front and center, but you did hear some concerns by some CIA people that this intelligence wasn't quite right, that there was some dissatisfaction among some members of the agency about the reliability of this reporting. Why didn't that become front and center? And how much disagreement was there about the evidence they had that Iraq was building this, you know, nuclear-rich country?
Well, the question before we went to war was, what kind of threat are we facing? And the Senate, in September 2002, before we went to war, asked the CIA to report on this. And I think we all remember what the result was. I think we all remember Colin Powell,
sure.
our Secretary of State, and at that time, the most trusted American in the world, going to the United Nations. And who was sitting right over his shoulder? George Tenet,
mm-hmm.
the Director of Central Intelligence.
Slam dunk George Tenet.
That's right.
Yep.
And General Powell told the nation, told the world, these are hard facts. This is our best intelligence. Iraq is bristling with chemical and biological weapons. We know this. Well, it was a pretty scary presentation and a very convincing one, and it was dead wrong, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what the CIA's best intelligence was at the time. The trouble was we didn't have any spies to speak of in Iraq. And the intelligence on the Iraqi arsenal was 4, 5, 6 years old.
Goodness gracious.
Now,
and then, I'm sorry.
This is what happens when intelligence fails. Intelligence can succeed, and it has in the past. When American intelligence succeeds, when the CIA succeeds, it can prevent a war. It can forestall a coup against an ally. It can save American lives. But when intelligence fails, soldiers die. And we go to war without having to. Mm-hmm. That is a disaster.
Yeah, we'll talk about the successes in the moment. Let's stay on the CIA for just a moment. You tell the story of the CIA backing a coup to install the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, coming to party on a CIA train, and one of the passengers was a young assassin named, of course, Saddam Hussein.
Throughout the world, throughout the Cold War, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, we, the United States, were engaged in a battle, the way we saw it, for control of the world against a ruthless and implacable adversary in the Soviet Union. And in almost every country in the world, the CIA and the KGB, the Russian Intelligence Service, went belly to belly, trying to gain influence, trying to gain advantage. And we won some and we lost some. But that was what the Cold War was all about, war by other means. We didn't want to start World War III with the Soviets, you know, with both sides armed with tens of thousands of nuclear warheads. It would have been the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we fought it by other means. And, you know, luckily for us, Soviet communism was a rotten political and economic system, and it collapsed. But that was how the war was fought throughout the Middle East, throughout Africa, throughout much of Latin America and the Western Hemisphere, a secret war for influence over third countries.
When you say that when it succeeds, it can stop war, what are the, and how many have there been, success stories?
Well, I think that the story of arms control, which is a very technical and tedious subject, has to be counted as a great success. Because in the early 1960s, we thought the Soviets had thousands of intercontinental ballistic missiles armed with warheads capable of striking the United States. The CIA helped develop the first spy satellites. They went up and they counted the missiles. You know how many they had?
Hmm.
Four.
Oh my gosh.
Not 4,000, not 400.
Oh
four.
My gosh.
Are
you kidding me?
So we began in the 60s and in the 70s talking to the Soviets about trying to control the levels of force we had arrayed at each other. Did we need tens of thousands of nuclear warheads? Maybe we could get by with 10,000 or 8,000
mm-hmm.
or 6,000. And the CIA contributed heavily to this. Now, did they assess Soviet force levels accurately all the time? No. Sometimes they overestimated, sometimes they underestimated. But this was an important process, and it helped keep the Cold War cold. And you got to give them credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
There are examples, and I cite them in the book, where a CIA agent in Taiwan, for example, this is a recruited Taiwanese military officer who had been working in secret for CIA for 20 years, sent out warning that the Chinese nationalists, the Taiwanese, were in the process of secretly building a nuclear weapon. And there was only one purpose for that, which was to aim it and maybe fire it at communist China.
Hmm.
But he didn't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the recruited CIA agent got the word out. The State Department spoke very directly and forcefully to the government in Taiwan, and they stood down.
Hmm.
Now, that's good intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
The record, unfortunately, is outweighed, and you know I'm proud to say that the Legacy of Ashes is a history written entirely on the record. There are no anonymous sources. There are no anonymous quotes in it. But the record is not good. The CIA has had a great reputation and a terrible record.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in you tell these stories about John Kennedy. Let me quote here you, the greatest tragedy in the story, the inability of presidents to understand the CIA and use it wisely. They got their information from movies, books, and Washington corridor chit-chat, so you have misuse and abuse. John Kennedy was struck by the fact that CIA officers didn't look like James Bond at all.
It is a fact that we as Americans, most of the information that we know about the CIA, or we think we know, about the CIA comes from movies and TV and books. And this includes presidents and members of Congress. you know, they think it's Mission Impossible or the Bourne Ultimatum or 24 or, you know, Get Smart. And it's not like that. It is a difficult, dirty, dangerous business, espionage overseas. And the business of analyzing intelligence at home, extraordinarily difficult. You are trying to report to the president about what's really going on abroad, mm-hmm. so that he doesn't have to rely on, you know, my employers, the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN, to tell him what's going on overseas.
Right.
To get a deeper cut of reality. It's a tall order.
And you tell the story, which I think may have piqued your interest in doing a book, of a CIA agent in Afghanistan who, when you were in Afghanistan, was asking you what was really going on there because he was back in the United States trying to study this land and be an agent there, but he wasn't even there. So you become the source of information.
Well, I was not a source for the CIA. Let's make that clear. But no, the first time I ever set foot inside CIA headquarters came about this way. It was 1987. I was 31 years old, and I determined that I wanted to go to Afghanistan to write about a very big, supposedly secret program that the CIA was running in conjunction with Pakistan and Egypt and China and other nations to smuggle billions of dollars of weapons to the Afghan Mujahideen, the holy warriors of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. who were fighting then in the seventh year of a brutal Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. So instead of writing this, you know, from the sterile corridors of Washington, I thought, well, I'll go to Afghanistan,
yeah.
see what's really happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I called up CIA. CIA had and has always had a public affairs department. It's an odd job, being the public information officer of the Central Intelligence Agency, but there it is. And I said, you know, I understand you people sometimes do country briefings for foreign correspondents who are going to strange places. I'm going to Afghanistan. How about it? No, he explained. Flat out no. So I went. I had a great trip. I came back to Washington about 3 months later, and I hadn't been back in town for more than a day when the phone rang. It was the guy from the CIA. Hey, Tim, how are you? How'd you like to come in for that briefing now?
Oh, my gosh.
So I went to CIA headquarters, and it's quite an impressive place. As you know, it's about 7 miles outside Washington, D.C., out in the woods, up the Potomac. And you walk in, and there's a sort of a soaring lobby. Alan Dulles built this in part as a monument to himself. elegant, ornate marble. And up on the left-hand wall, which must be 40 feet high, engraved in bas-relief letters a foot high, is a phrase from the Gospel of John. And ye shall know the truth, mm-hmm. and the truth shall make you free. Mm-hmm. Well, I was hooked. Who wouldn't be?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, I, you know, went in for this briefing, and the four analysts I was talking to, none of them had ever been to Afghanistan.
Goodness.
And these are the CIA guys who are trying to explain what's going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It struck me.
Yeah. That is striking. We'll welcome phone calls for you. We're talking this hour with Tim Weiner. His book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, is just out in paperback. And we're welcoming calls at 800-486-8655. This is a National Book Award winner, National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, one of the best books of the year. So says Time, The Post, The New York Times, The Economist, The Boston Globe, Los Angeles Times, and Salon. And The Boston Globe says it is must reading for every presidential candidate who wants to understand why the nation repeatedly stumbles into one disaster abroad after another. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050, Milwaukee callers, or send an email at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Tim is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's reported on American intelligence for more than 20 years, and as a reporter for the New York Times, has investigated CIA covert operations firsthand and worked as a foreign correspondent in some 18 nations all over the world. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go to some phone calls for Tim Weiner, author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, just out in paperback. Alan from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Alan.
Comment and question. I think there's a big difference between wrong intelligence and lying intelligence. And my question to you, sir, is in your fantastic book, Blank Check, you told of an anecdote of Ed Koch receiving a briefing from the CIA, which he related to you about how the CIA and probably the American intelligence community in general has their fingers in almost every bit of funding appropriation for every agency in the country. And so they have this absolutely huge black budget with essentially no oversight. Could you please talk about that?
Well, there is a system identified as the black budget. I did write a book about it 17 years ago. I'm very glad that you read it. The book had the shelf life of yogurt, so it's good to hear its name mentioned. The way we go about financing secret military intelligence programs, secret military and intelligence programs in this country, is arguably against the Constitution. The Constitution says, Article 1, Clause 9, Paragraph 7, that you have to have a public budget in this country. You can't have a secret budget. Congress has to account for the money it spends. We in this country spend somewhere between 50 and 60 billion, with a B, dollars a year on intelligence programs. And this money is hidden in the Pentagon's budget through false line items, phony accounts, and code names. Now, this is an example of the struggle that we've been through in this country ever since the CIA was created in 1947. And that struggle is this. How do you run a secret intelligence service in an open American democracy? We have been struggling with this question for 20 years now, and I don't think we figured it out yet.
Huh. What about the money? I think at one point you write about, and I can't remember what agent was telling you this, that the money's flowing freely. It's sort of hard to imagine people in the CIA saying, oh, we were out in Asia, we were having a great time, and a lot of parties, having a lot of fun. You imagine the life of a CIA agent to be pretty harsh. For many, it evidently was not so.
Well, I think it is harsh right now if you're working overseas. But money is no object right now. It was very much an object in the decade between the end of the Cold War and the 9/11 attacks.
Mm.
But since then, the intelligence budget has roughly doubled.
Mm-hmm.
Money is no object, whether it's for technical surveillance or hiring new people. The CIA has been on a hiring binge, in fact. The president ordered it in 2004 to increase its ranks of clandestine service officers and analysts by 50%. The consequence of this is, you know, these people don't grow on trees.
Right.
That today, as we speak today, 50% or more of the CIA workforce has less than 5 years' experience.
Oh, my.
And by the agency's own standards, these folks are trainees. They are not good to go.
Hmm. And have they learned that it's probably a good idea, if you're going to be an agent, to understand the culture and speak the language of where you're going?
Now, this is the great thing. This is the great thing. In my estimation, one of the reasons that intelligence fails in this country is that we have relied to a great extent on gadgets and machines to gather intelligence. Now, we can build all the spy satellites we want, and we do. We try at $1 billion a pop or more. But at the end of the day, the only way to know what another person thinks is to talk to him. This is the job of intelligence, to know your enemy. And the only way to know your enemy is to talk to him, and that is the business of spies. You cannot talk to him if you cannot speak his language.
Right.
And we are not sharp on the language and the history and the culture of the people in whom we're interested in. Now, this is not a problem unique to the CIA. This is an American problem. But it makes intelligence all that much harder if you don't know what the other person's talking about.
Yeah, I would imagine. Right? It's kind of basic.
So we rely to an inordinate degree on, quote, friendly, unquote, foreign intelligence services, the Pakistanis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, to do our dirty work for us. And, Kathleen, there are no friendly foreign intelligence services. There are none. Nations don't have friends. They have interests.
Interesting. Here's an email from Jim from Green Bay. I've read numerous statements by professional CIA analysts who say their conclusions or dissents were suppressed on aluminum tubes, on curveball, on biological weapons. So the intelligence was actually politicized and cherry-picked by an administration that wanted a fast track to war. This is not the same as failing.
Well, ultimately, the result is a failure. The post hoc defense of the CIA was, well, look at this footnote on page 93 where we raise questions about the aluminum tubes and the guy from the Defense Intelligence Agency overrode them. It was the job of the Director of Central Intelligence and the job of the CIA itself to coordinate and to harmonize American intelligence from all sources and to report to the president. A footnote on page 93 may get you off the hook morally, but the reporting, the conclusions, were all one way on weapons of mass destruction. And the facts, as they turned out, were all the other way. So, you know, I appreciate the fact that you know, a dissenting footnote on page 93 of the report may exist. Did it make a difference? It did not.
Thanks very much, Alan, for the call. Let's go to David from Madison. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I was a analyst in the CIA in the period from 84 to 96, some of the period that you're talking about. And I want to say that the fact that we at that time would brief somebody like you was very much an evidence of wanting to hear all the information, wanting to get down to the facts. I must say that in terms of briefing people going out, I participated in a number of briefings of people going out as well. I would not say there was any systematic effort to deny at least the framework of thought to people going out. I'm not sure that everybody was accorded that
privilege. It's not
information,
a right.
But certainly it was not a practice of the agency. But I would say that one thing the agency does is sift through all the information, and at the top are a bunch of nerdy people who sit at computers all day long, who really do try and take all the information from every place, the covert, the satellites, and then a huge body of written material and sift it out and say what it means. But the fact is that you're dealing with what's often called the fog of battle, and it really is a situation where you're peering into a very murky environment, and correct or incorrect answers are often very elusive.
That's right. That's all true. Do you have a question?
Pardon me?
Do you have a question?
Well, I would just say that if you could react to the or put some fine-tuning on this idea that the CIA missed the calls for 20 years, the calls about the Soviet Union, for example, The key issue with the Soviet Union was what was in Gorbachev's heart and what was in the heart of his leadership. And it was very hard to determine exactly what was in Gorbachev's heart. But at some point it became clear that he was moving on a path of change. I don't think the CIA missed that. Would the Soviet Union collapse with that path of change? That was a pretty profound issue, but step by step, the agency was quite I would say, quite both inside and outside the Soviet government. To say that we missed that call, I think, was a quite erroneous way of putting it.
I didn't say that the CIA missed the fall of the Soviet Union. I said that presidents, and I would include every president up unto George Herbert Walker Bush, had major problems with the Soviet estimate, rightly or wrongly, and that part of the struggle for the CIA has been trying to satisfy presidents. After all, the CIA works for them. The fact is, and the record shows, that the CIA did not know that Gorbachev had told the Warsaw Pact in May 1987 that the Soviets would not invade Eastern Europe to shore up their empire, or that Gorbachev had told the leader of Afghanistan in July 1987 that the Soviets were going to start pulling out. And the agency was really flabbergasted in December 1987 when Gorbachev came to Washington and, you know, throngs of adoring American citizens hailed this guy as a hero on the streets. You know, we spent, over the course of more than 30 years, American intelligence spent close to $250 billion, $250 billion, on spy satellites and electronic eavesdropping equipment built to monitor the Soviet military. And, you know, did we accurately assess their arsenals? I think we did. Did we understand that potatoes were rotting in the field for lack of gasoline to drive them to market? I'm not sure we did.
Mm-hmm. What about the tell me what the modus operandi is here. Did we have a lot of spies within the Soviet Union? Do we have a lot of spies in Iraq?
Well, at one time we had about a dozen Soviet recruited agents working for the United States, but then a CIA officer named Aldrich Ames, beginning in the mid-1980s, betrayed them all, and they all died. He sold them out. He was working for Moscow. He was paid $2.7 million in blood money. And this drunken bum, Aldrich Ames, had somehow risen to the position of the chief of the counterintelligence branch of the Soviet division of the Central Intelligence Agency. And he had access to the true identities of everyone of a dozen. That was the stable of Soviet spies. That was all of them. And at the same time, an FBI agent named Robert Hansen, whose betrayal was not discovered until 2001, they gave away the crown jewels. So by the late 1980s, the number of spies was zero.
Well, it's amazing to me that you list in the book all the mistakes that were made, you know, with the Soviet Union, which you've talked about, South Korea, which we haven't talked about, the atom bomb in India, what the consequences of funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan would be, Iraq invading Kuwait. They were not onto that. They weren't onto so many monumental events in the world.
I think your caller made one important point, the former CIA analyst, which is that by the end of the Cold War, and I think before the end of the Cold War, the CIA had built up a considerable expertise over 40 years on a number of subjects of great import to the United States. And then when the Cold War was over, however, a lot of people left. A lot of people left. And by the mid-1990s, the place was running on fumes. When two of our embassies were attacked at once in Africa 10 years ago, we knew then that we were up against a new kind of enemy, because two at once is not twice as hard. Two at once is 100 times as hard. And a few weeks after Al-Qaeda blew up those two American embassies in Africa, George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, wrote a secret report to the White House, and it said that unless this country fundamentally changed the way in which it gathered and analyzed intelligence, that we as a nation were going to suffer, and I quote, a catastrophic systemic intelligence failure. And the date of that report was September 11th, 1998.
Oh, my gosh.
And I would argue that the catastrophic systemic failure was not 9/11. It came a year after that in the CIA's abysmal reporting on the Iraqi arsenal.
Right. And led us to this horrendous war and so many deaths and no way out and such a tragedy.
Well, you know, the president, among others, was pretty hell-bent on going to war, but it is one of history's great ifs, great what-ifs, pardon me. What if the reporting had been accurate?
Right.
What if the reporting had said, you know what, there is no Iraqi arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. He destroyed them years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He would like us to believe that he has this arsenal because it's a deterrent against attack, or so he thinks, so Saddam thinks. But it's not there. Would we have gone to war in the face of accurate intelligence reporting? We'll never know.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe we would have. Yeah.
We'll never know.
Yeah. David from Madison, thank you. Brian from Preston, Minnesota is next. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi, everybody. My question is if the guest has any knowledge or any insight into the amount of infighting within the agency and any sort of power grabs from between the higher-ups, like, say, the director and the directorate of operations and things of that nature, that can skew the way intelligence is put forth or what type of intelligence is put forth or the priority of a certain type of intelligence. And this is just from within the agency, not by any outside force.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Thank you for it.
Yeah.
If you read Legacy of Ashes, you will see that this struggle never ends, that it is a continuing argument over what the intelligence is and what the intelligence means. When you've got a good director of central intelligence, one who understands what intelligence is and what it can and cannot do for the United States, the system can work. When you have a bad director of central intelligence who is more than willing to skew the intelligence to the president's preconceptions, or worse yet, his own preconceptions, then you got trouble. And an example of that would be Bill Casey, who was President Reagan's director of intelligence for 6 years. If you're going to run a secret intelligence service in an open American democracy, you've got to have people you can trust at the helm. And that means you don't hire people like Bill Casey.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other guys? Alan Dulles, talk about him for a while.
Well, Alan Dulles was, you know, by the time President Kennedy came to power, Dulles had been director of Central Intelligence for 8 years, and he had been the leading figure in American intelligence really since the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He was pushing 70. He was a legend. And his brother, in the Eisenhower years, had been the Secretary of State for almost 7 years, John Foster Dulles.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite a brother act, having the two of them running the State Department and American intelligence at the same time. By the time President Kennedy got to know him, Dulles was, one, a legend, and two, a tired old man who had spent years and years and years buffing and polishing his own reputation. And it was Alan Dulles who told the new president, "Mr. President, we've got a plan to take care of Fidel Castro. We're going to invade Cuba. We've worked on this plan for a year. It's a good plan. Chances of success, very, very high." In effect, he said, "It's a slam dunk, Mr. President." And that was the Bay of Pigs, where the CIA sent 1,500 trained Cuban agents up against Fidel Castro's 60,000-man army into a mangrove swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is now the name Bay of Pigs is synonymous with snafu, with, you know, with intelligence failure.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very bad move. How do you think the President of the United States fell when that one got foisted on him?
Yeah, right. And then again, the CIA failed to see the Soviet missiles coming to the island of Cuba?
Well, a proximate consequence of the failed American invasion of Cuba was the decision of the Soviets to send nuclear warheads to Cuba. And the CIA, as an institution, put out an estimate, as their reports are called, in September 1962, saying the Soviets would never, ever, ever put nuclear missiles in Cuba, that it was against every fiber of their past performance, of their policy, that it would never happen. And a few weeks later, we discovered there were, in fact, Soviet missiles in Cuba.
More phone calls for Tim in a moment. Tim Weiner is our guest. His book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, has just been published in paperback by Anchor Books. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee, or email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tim Weiner, his book is Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Another email, actually, we have too many to get to. Tim, could you ask Tim, what's the status of the CIA's secret rendition program?
Well, the fact that it has been revealed means that it has been slowed. But the fact is that in the 15 months or so after 9/11, the CIA rounded up more than 3,000 people all over the world. And, we now know that probably 2,800 of them, were not serious terrorists. They were knuckleheads. And the consequence of this now is that we have 14 so-called high-value terrorists awaiting trial at Guantanamo. And we've got hundreds of nobodies, maybe thousands of nobodies, that we rounded up and we had to let go.
Hmm. Let's go to another phone call and to Daryl from Delavan. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, I had just a couple quick comments. Thank you for the program and a question. I believe it was the CIA that went into Afghanistan first after 9/11.
That is right.
At least, that's what was stated by Kofor Black of the CIA in a documentary on Frontline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's before any U.S. Marines or Army went in.
There were some U.S. Army special forces as well, but they were the first in.
In addition, at that time, it was reported the CIA distributed $70 million to Northern Alliance troops being released from prisons in Afghanistan to help the U.S.
You're talking about cash?
My question was all or part of $70 million distributed used for poppy seed, hence the opium problem Afghanistan is experiencing now?
No. People have been growing. I've been to Afghanistan half a dozen times over the last 20 years. Poppy is the basis of a large part of the Afghan economy. And so there's no direct connection. I mean, the economy generally runs on guns and drugs, and it has for years.
And thanks very much for the call. Email coming in, Dan from Fox Point. You mentioned Aldrich and Hansen, who betrayed names of CIA agents and were tried for treason. Please tell us how it is that the betrayal of covert agent Valerie Plame by Libby Rove and Cheney does not qualify as treason as well.
Oh, that was quite a different matter. I mean, in the first two instances, you've got CIA and FBI senior officers committing treason by selling out our recruited agents to Moscow for cash and other considerations. The Valerie Plame kerfuffle was a consequence of the political sniping that was going on between the White House and the CIA in the wake of the Iraq WMD fiasco. Valerie Plame got winged in that crossfire. Scooter Libby got it in the neck. He's healed nicely since then, thank you.
Right.
And this is what happens when the CIA and the White House get crossways. You know, people get hurt.
Right. Margaret from Janesville, hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
My question is, if a Democrat were in power in the White House right now, would we even be having this discussion? And you said 50% of the CIA are new and untrained, but that means 50% are very well trained as well.
True. So the glass is half full. I think the next president, whoever it is probably going to renounce torture as an instrument of American foreign policy, and this will help the CIA a great deal as it goes forward to try and recruit foreign agents from the Nations of Islam, from the Mediterranean to the Pacific. That practice has been a stain on the honor of the United States, and I think it has made the job of the CIA a lot tougher. It was already very tough, but the job part of it, a crucial part of it, is recruiting spies getting people, foreigners, to commit treason against their country, their cause, their creed, and work for the United States in secret. That job has been made a lot tougher by the way in which this administration has conducted the war on terror.
Hmm. And what's the most successful way to recruit spies? How do you do that?
Well, money is always appreciated. weapons or other things of value are often appreciated. Ideology will work. It's a little harder right now than it was during the Cold War. You can take them out of a bad situation and promise them a better situation in their life. You can promise you'll take care of their kids if something happens to them. But money, ideology, things of value are always appreciated in the recruitment of spies.
You asked the question, I think it's in the new afterword to the book, which is worth asking at this point in the show, is an open democracy capable of building and sustaining an effective secret intelligence service? And then you go on to say, but with Islamic terrorists vowing to set off a nuclear device in an American city, there isn't much choice but to keep on trying.
Well, that's actually from a review of the book. I don't disagree with that. We have been trying for 60 years now to figure out how do you run a secret intelligence service in an open democratic society. I don't think we've successfully figured it out yet, but we have to try.
Yeah. Let's go to John. Thanks very much, Margaret, for your call. John from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I read your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a good book. You know, it filled in the personality conflicts that I wasn't familiar with. From what you wrote, though, the head of the CIA can determine, he can cherry pick the experts like Bush did with his B group under President Ford, or Casey, as head under Reagan, actually redacted and rewrote intelligence estimates.
Yes, he did.
So these are all variables that enter in. But the thing where I really disagree with you is this. When the intelligence group gave their estimate to Bush, there were caveats as far as how much you should trust these various guys with all of this.
We're talking about the Iraq WMD reporting?
Yes, we are. Okay. We're talking about Haidari. He was fluttered. He failed. Al-Libi was renditioned to Egypt. He was tortured to get that information. We know that Curveball was a member of Chalabi's INC.
Right.
He was an alcoholic. He was extremely unreliable.
The point of your question is?
We have Hussein Kamel, who said they were all the various bacteriologic and chemical weapons were destroyed when he was the head of
That's right.
way back in the 90s. The point is, all of these people were the key players that were giving the critical information. Every last one of them was unreliable. And, you know, Feith established his own B group to manipulate information. Colin Powell's intelligence group said a lot of this stuff it doesn't hold up. And he was talking about Wilson's findings. He was talking about aluminum tubes. And then you take Jay Rockefeller's group. Their recent report says exactly what I'm saying. He said they took this information, and then they said, no, we don't know it with like a 10 or 15% probability. We know it beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yes, I don't disagree with any of that. The administration took the CIA's reporting on WMD, which was wrong, and then it hyped it another level to the smoking mushroom cloud level. It instilled fear in people, and people don't think clearly when they're afraid. I don't disagree with any of what you said.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. And we're almost at the end of this. I was interested in the Boston Globe's review of your book, saying that all presidential candidates need to read this book. What are they going to learn from it that they need to know?
They're going to learn that we as a nation need better intelligence, and that we get it when presidents pay direct attention to the CIA. The CIA as an institution is exquisitely sensitive to presidential command and control if the president gives it clear, direct, lawful orders. I also think they'll learn something. I'm going to quote Colin Powell as we say goodbye to one another. They're going to learn the wisdom of the following quotation from Colin Powell. What is the greatest threat facing us now? Colin Powell asked. People will say it's terrorism, but are there any
terrorist in the world who can change the American way of life or our political system? No. Can they knock down a building? Yes. Can they kill somebody? Yes. But can they change us? No. Only we can change ourselves. The only thing that can really destroy us is us, and we shouldn't do it to ourselves. And we shouldn't use fear for political purposes, scaring people to death so that they will vote for you, or scaring people to death so that we create a terror industrial complex. That's a quote from Colin Powell that's in the new afterword to Legacy of Ashes.
Thank you, Tim, so much for all your work for the book. Thanks. And the conversation. Tim Weiner, the book is Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, just out in paperback, published by Anchor Books. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for all your well-informed calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Many more hours of great conversation ahead on the Ideas Network. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. It's a minute before 11. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.